Coming up on Tech News Weekly, gaming disorder is now classified by the World Health Organization. The broadband industry has outdone Cambridge Analytica for a few decades now. How smartwatches and wearables are saving lives. Instagram's launch of IGTV is to take on YouTube. And do we really need to bring odor to virtual reality? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 37, recorded Thursday, June 21st, 2018.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. And I'm ready. Let's do this. It's a nice day outside. Yesterday was cold. Today's warm. I'm pumped up.
Me too. So some big news this week is that the World Health Organization officially added gaming disorder to its International Statistical Classification of Diseases and related health problems. The term describes anyone who can't control his or her gaming behavior and gives gaming priority so that it takes precedence over other interests and daily activities despite negative consequences. Now, experts and video game lovers have had mixed responses to the news. Some wonder why gaming has been called out specifically and how it's any different than gambling addiction that already has been classified as a disease. Now, we have all probably met people who might fit these characteristics, but that doesn't necessarily mean all of us have to immediately burn our Xboxes or delete Fortnite from our phones.
You probably don't want to burn Xboxes.
No, don't do that anyway. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Mike Bishop, founder of Summerland Camps, a program for kids who have lost their way with online distractions. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Mike.
Hey, Megan. Thanks for having me back.
So we spoke last summer about the benefits of a tech detox. Tell us now your thoughts on this news of the gaming disorder designation.
Well, I think it's great that this is great news because it opens up potential insurance reimbursement for families. It also leads to legitimacy of the issue that for us in the industry have known that this has been a valid a disorder for a long time, and it finally, you know, lends credence to the to what we see every day. So those of us in the industry are very happy for the World Health Organization's decision to classify gaming as an actual disorder.
So does this mean programs like yours, Summerland Camps, would get maybe be covered by health insurance?
Potentially, that is what we are hoping for. Right now, what we do is we bill for group and individual therapy sessions that are separate from the fun, more camp-like aspects of our program. We bill whatever we can, you know, at the present time that might be for an adjustment disorder. As a lot of people know, ADHD has a high comorbidity to gaming addiction. So ADHD is certainly something that we can bill for. But until now, there's really no clear diagnostic code to classify this under. So this is really great news.
I have to imagine that reaching the point where the World Health Organization steps in to qualify something like this comes arrives on the back of a lot of research to support it, obviously. Do you feel like there's enough research at this point to support that? Obviously, they did, but what can you tell us about kind of the background there?
Yeah, there has been a wealth of research that's come out really in the last 10 to 15 years, not only on video game addiction, but social media overuse, misuse. We certainly have entire journals now dedicated to the effect of media on violence and aggression. A lot of studies we saw came after the Columbine shooting. A lot of people don't know that. So those boys that were involved in, you know, kind of the first school shooting that started this, you know, string of school shootings we've had, they were obsessed with the game Doom so much to the point where they actually broke into the code and gave themselves unlimited lives. At that point, a lot of researchers said, you know, there's something with video games and the way it affects young people, the way it affects our perception of violence, the way it desensitizes us to violence, and also how it kind of draws us in. You know, anyone can just go on a job board now and search for video game psychologist and see that these video game companies are actively recruiting research psychologists, clinical psychologists, and you got to ask, why are they doing that? These are billion-dollar companies, and their loyalty is not to the mental health of a teenager. It is to their shareholders. So they're going to do whatever they can to make their games as habit-forming as possible.
One question I have is kind of a follow-up on that, because it's interesting that, you know, you kind of bring up the long-standing argument, you know, that people are either ardently for or against this idea that video games can, you know, foster kind of violent tendencies outside of the virtual world. Are you, in your experience, I mean, you're working with kids on a regular mm-hmm. basis, obviously you can't talk about anyone in particular, and we don't want to know that, but are you kind of seeing the flip side of that, the meeting the kid that you kind of feel through your interaction with them that, like, doing this experience may have actually kind of prevented something like that to that degree? Because that's a very serious degree, and maybe it's hard to even know whether that's a possibility or not.
Yeah, and I think this almost warrants its own conversation that could, I mean, you know, this is a hotly debated topic. Sure. However, the American Psychological Association did put out a study, they created a focus group to look at what we call a meta-analysis. So there were several meta-analyses done on the effect of video game violence and if that affects real-life violence. And so what they did is they looked at five or six meta-analysis studies that were done. And the statement from the APA is essentially, this debate is over as to whether video game violence has an effect on real-life violence. And their statement is that it does. Now, I will say the effect size is small. But what's important is that study after study after study has shown that there is an effect size. Now, sometimes parents ask me, so my kid plays, you know, violent video games, and they really love, you know, violent video games. Is that going to make them, you know, a school shooter? The answer is no. That in itself does not make someone become a violent or aggressive person. But what we do know is that even just there was one study that was done, for example, they had people watch they're exposed to violent media for 4 hours, and then the random group exposed to cooperative media for 4 hours. And then what the researchers did is they set up catastrophe after the subjects walked out of being exposed to the violent or nonviolent media. And what they found was that across the board, people that were exposed to violent media took 36% longer to respond to. What it was that there was a woman with crutches and her leg was in a cast and she dropped one of the crutches. And so, you know, it has this cumulative effect on our perception of what is okay. And you also have to think that when you're playing a violent video game, it's stimulating your fight or flight part of your brain. And I'm sure many parents out there have had the experience, your child is pretty much calm, normal, but then they're playing a violent game and you tell them to get off and they lash out at you, you know, mom, 5 more minutes. I told you, if I quit this game, I get kicked off my group you would never see that if they're like, you know, folding their clothes or doing their homework. Sure. So, I mean, without question, it does have an effect. It's just it's a small effect. And what we see is essentially a stacking of effects. For example, if you are naturally a bully, you're coming from a home where you've witnessed domestic violence, you're naturally a physical person, and then you add on to that you play violent video games, you are much more likely to commit a violent act.
Yeah, I think that I totally agree with you. This, we could talk for an hour about this. I mean, a lot of it is semantics, right? Like, there's effect. Right. Like, violent video games can affect you. We're not saying, nor were you saying, that violent video games caused Columbine. That, you know, that, right. that it's an effect. It's proven, scientifically proven, that will have some effect. But that's different, especially legally different than, like, this, you know, X causes Y. But
exactly. It's when people ask me this question, I usually respond by saying, it's a lot more complicated than just giving you a yes right. or no answer. It's just not a, it's, you know, it's almost like you just want to hand them a book and say, here, go explore this, because it's not simple. Yeah, it's not a simple yes or no answer.
So we know everything in moderation is good, whether you're talking about violent video games, non-violent video games, chocolate. Social media, chocolate.
Although not really.
But how do you know what moderation is? Like, how do we gauge what a moderate user is? I mean, we're always comparing each other with other parents, but, you know, kids are very different. Like, how do you tell what moderate use is?
Well, and that's a great question. So at our program, Summerlin Camps, we try to find that answer for each person individually. From a teenager's perception, if they're interacting with their friends online, then everybody's online, because that's who their friends are. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, if you were playing for the football team or playing for the basketball team, everybody's playing basketball or everybody's into football, because that's who your friends are. So it's you know, the first thing we like to do is to create a reset opportunity where we're disengaging from screens and helping them, you know, try out other sports and hobbies and interests and, you know, whether that's athletic interests or hobbies or just books or whatever, and, you know, try to incorporate some other things into their life. Where you draw that line, I think, depends on the child. So I think there are some kids out there that can handle 2 hours of video games on a Saturday and Sunday, and maybe an hour on a school night. Personally, I limit my kids to no video games on school nights and 2 hours on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And for our family, that's what works. And they, you know, are able to perform okay in school. Generally, what I'm getting at our program are people that have just gone way overboard with their boundaries and need to kind of take accountability for how much time they're playing and think about the future and, you know, what goals they want to accomplish and learn how to structure their day. So one thing I have all my campers do is we carry a journal and we make a daily plan for that journal. And the hope is that they will continue that journal when they go home, for finishing high school and on to college. That's why all of our camps are on college campuses, because ultimately what we're doing is we're preparing them for that transition for mom and dad policing screen activity to them policing the screen activity themselves. And I'm not anti-video game. I think that video games play an important role in our society. I think, you know, after a stressful day of classes, to relax and play half an hour of video games, to connect with others through social media, I think that plays an important part of identity development. So one thing I make really clear to our campers and staff is that we're actually not anti-video game. What we are is pro achieving your life purpose. And if you're sitting there for 10 hours playing a video game, you're not achieving your life purpose, especially if it's affecting your health and your weight and your social skills, and, you know, you've fallen behind socially.
Yeah, it's. I think that it is. It's really tough, because I think what you said before, that these, to know, to teach your kids that video game makers are really designing these programs to be addicting. Like, if you look at Fortnite, which I haven't really played, but I've understood that there's a way in which it works, in which it's very quick, and then you die, and then you sit around and wait to have another life. And I'm sure I've got lots of emails saying this isn't exactly accurate, but the way that it is set up, it feeds that kind of, okay, I'm not going to do anything else. Whereas something like Minecraft doesn't have that same thing built into it. It's not designed to keep you there in any way.
Right. And so in what you're describing there is, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. The game manufacturers are getting more and more sophisticated at getting us to invest more and more time with their games. Because obviously they're dedicated to their shareholders and not teenagers. And so their interest is to get you to play as much as possible. Because most games now are connected to the internet, through the Xbox or whether you're playing online, it's giving them this huge amount of data to figure out, okay, if we respawn every 5 minutes, or if, you know, you have to press the button 100 times to defeat this monster versus 150 times, you know, people will keep playing. And so if you think about this cumulative effect that they've, you know, they have so much data now that they've gotten really, really sophisticated at getting us to dedicate huge amounts of time to video games. And unfortunately, I think when we look back 10, 15 years from now, we'll look at games like Fortnite as like, you know, Pac-Man and Space Invaders. Last time I went to Walmart, I noticed even at Walmart now they have virtual reality headsets. The price point has come down. You know, as a teenager, all of us struggled in high school. We all had, you know, our off days. So if you're getting bullied, if you had a bad interaction, you felt like nobody talked to you, whatever, why would you, you know, try to go outside and socialize when you could retreat to this perfect world, this virtual world? And it's a real threat. Game manufacturers are only going to get more and more sophisticated at luring us into this essentially perfect virtual world.
And not just the game manufacturers. I mean, they're, you know, missing in our chat room says, you know, it's the same thing for sitting around 10 hours and watching TV. And you can bet Netflix is doing the same thing. That's why it comes up. Watch the next episode. Yep. Watch the next.
Sure.
I mean, we even call it binge watching, which is, you know, it's an addictive word. So, thank you so much, Dr. Mike, for visiting us again. You can find out more, and you can take the screen addiction survey at summerlanecamps.com. Have fun this summer with your campers.
Thank you so much, Megan. I appreciate you having me back on.
Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, John. Bye.
All right. Everybody's tracking everybody online, or so it seems, while tech companies like Facebook are being publicly held to task for how user tracking data is unprotected and mismanaged. The broadband industry has been slyly tracking users on a much deeper level for decades. Joining us to take a closer look at the elephant in the room is Carl Bode from TechDirt. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hey there. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's great to get you on. You wrote a bunch of awesome articles. We'll link to them in the show notes. I call the wireless industry the elephant in the room, mainly because, as you've pointed out in your articles, people seem to be selectively outraged when it comes to this kind of behavior tracking, letting some off the hook while others holding their feet to the fire. Let's start with some of the ways that the broadband industry has put things like Cambridge Analytica scandal to shame in the past by comparison.
Sure. So, you know, over the years, they've really tried to test their luck. They've kept pushing and pushing harder and harder to see how much data they can collect, how many people they can sell it to, how hard regulators will push back on those efforts. And they've generally found that there hasn't been much of a pushback either by the press or regulators or anybody else. So, you know, for example, AT&T for years was charging their broadband customers hundreds of additional dollars per year just to opt out of snoopertizing that they have, the behavioral ad tech that they use. Other companies like Cable One was a company that bragged at one point about how it would really like to use customer financial data and credit records to avoid having to work too hard to provide good customer service to low credit customers. A few years ago, Verizon was also caught actively modifying user wireless packets so they could track users around the internet. And they didn't bother to tell anybody about that. It took security researchers, I think, 2 years before they even realized it was happening. So there's plenty of examples. They also, for a long time, they collected clickstream data, which is pretty much every site you visit. And when reporters would ask them what they were doing or the details of how much data they were collecting, they would just either not answer at all or give very vague answers. And that was allowed to stand. Nobody really seemed to care. And it's only really evolved since then into location data.
And you wrote about late last year that the ISPs were lobbying the FCC to block privacy protection rules at the state level. Where exactly did that stem from? Was that the Verizon the Verizon case that you were talking about, or is that something else? And why were they able to do that?
Yeah, well, it started with the FCC. You know, like I said, Verizon was caught changing user packets without telling anybody or providing opt-out tools, and the FCC noticed that. And I think it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. So the FCC thought, okay, we'll pass some pretty modest privacy rules saying, okay, consumers have to opt in to have sensitive data collected. But what happened is the ISPs basically convinced Congress to completely eviscerate that protection before it could even take place last March. So, yeah, they were successful in getting rid of it. Ironically, that law would have prevented all of these location data scandals that we've seen because consumers would have to give their express opt-in consent
right.
to agree to have their data shared in this way, which now doesn't exist.
So I understand, like, I understand that people should care more about this than Cambridge Analytica. But, I mean, there was something about that Facebook story that everyone could understand. Here's, you know, you knew people that took those quizzes. You kind of wanted to take them yourself. And you understood the data that you were putting up there. And your understanding of what they were doing with it was really wrong. How can you make people, how can you convince people that this is also a problem? Because I think, you know, people don't understand. It's like packets. What, you know, I don't understand. Like, how can you make the public understand that this is just as bad for your privacy?
I've been trying, and I'm not sure I have an answer to that question just yet. I work at it pretty hard, but I've not succeeded. I don't feel like yet. I think the Facebook story really resonated because it had so many kind of interesting political angles and Russians. You know, that really caught the public's attention. I think in broadband, you have the problem that people see. The broadband landscape is this homogenous place where if you pick one broadband provider, it's pretty much the same as the other one because there's limited competition both in wireless and wired. So I think there's a frustration there. I honestly do not believe people are going to realize the scope of the problem here until we have a few more scandals like the ones we've already seen. Just having a conversation is the start, really. Just talking about how much data they're collecting, getting them to be a little more transparent about what they're doing with it, who they're selling it to. Which we really haven't been. I mean, a lot of this stuff happens with very, very little oversight. I think people assume that there's somebody out there making sure that these ISPs are behaving well, and there really is not. The
right.
assumption that there's someone watching the watchers is not accurate in this case.
Someone was watching, Ron Wyden, had a probe anyways. Tell us a little bit about what he found exactly. This is in relation to the Location Smart and the Securus kind of incidents that we're kind of dancing around right now, but share a little background on that specifically and what Ron Wyden did to kind of turn this around a little bit.
So May last month was really kind of a turning point in this whole thing because starting on May 10th, there was, I think, a New York Times report showing that a law enforcement officer was abusing this data to spy on other judges and other law enforcement officers. There was also a report that Securus, which is a company that provides phone communication services to prisons had been hacked, and a lot of that information had leaked out, or at least usernames and IDs had leaked out. There was then that whole scandal involving Location Smart, which is another company that buys location data from providers and then sells it to other companies. So that pretty much got it rolling. And Wyden's investigation wasn't necessarily a full investigation as much as it was just some letters he sent to these companies saying, okay, what are you doing? What are you doing to ensure this data is secure? How are you going to ensure that this doesn't happen again? And some of the responses were okay. You know, Verizon said they'd stop doing it for now until they could figure out ways to ensure the data was secure. Other companies were really kind of ambiguous, like T-Mobile simply said they wouldn't share this data with shady middlemen, which they didn't define. You know, Sprint 2, a company that T-Mobile is trying to merge with, didn't give very clear answers. They didn't say who they're selling this location data to. So it's all very murky. I mean, it did bring it into the public eye a little bit, but I'm noticing that it's already kind of fading out. Whereas, again, as you saw with Facebook, that was in the headlines for months and months.
Sure.
And I arguably would think that this scandal is notably more significant.
It reminds me of the mortgage crisis a little bit. Like, this person sold your loan to this person who sold your loan to this person, then suddenly you have no idea, you know, where everything is. Like, I mean, that's you write that one of the biggest problems is the wireless carriers have figured out a way to operate outside of normal privacy guidelines. Can you explain a little bit about what they're doing, sort of passing the buck?
Yeah, so in Verizon's case, they admitted in their response letter to Wyden that they sell the data to these location broker middlemen who then in turn are selling them to as many as 75 different companies. And so what happens is you get consumers opting in once or giving at least this vague consent based on the 50-page mouse print that they read in their end user agreement. And then phone companies are taking that consent as basically as a green light to then share it down this chain. But at no point do consumers realize that 75 different companies are already sharing this data, and no explicit consent was given for them to be shared. So they've taken a loophole in existing law and just kind of taken full advantage without regulators really giving much of a damn, frankly. So it's been very curious. Well, eventually we're going to, the problem is eventually they're going, we're going to need eventually something more than winks and, you know, pinky squares to protect consumer data, you know, which is basically what we're relying on now. And these companies are absolutely terrified of real privacy laws coming into effect, which is why they've, you know, tried to concede here and said, okay, we won't share this data for now. But again, it's, most of the responses were very vague. They didn't specify, you know, how long they won't share data with, who they share it with, et cetera. So it's, we're going to require a lot more pressure to get them to actually start behaving and be more transparent with consumers, I think.
So then what you're not saying is that broadband providers are totally done with these location data aggregators. That's never going to happen again.
No, absolutely. There's too much money to be made here. I mean, the fact that they were willing to suspend this tells you how much their legal departments realize that there could be a problem here. Because that's a lot. They sell this data to everybody from city planners to marketers. I mean, it's a huge windfall. And so to think that they would just stop this is probably naive on our part.
Yeah.
But we'll see if we can. There's going to be more scandals. And I think over time, this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue.
So if winking isn't the answer, if the old wink, wink isn't the answer, is regulation the answer? And if so, what would that look like?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, you have the European regulation that came in, and I know there's a lot of problems with that. And I doubt at this point this particular Congress would be able to pass a law that would really constrain these companies or have the willpower to pass such a law. So I honestly don't know. That's going to require a real conversation between stakeholders, the companies themselves, consumer advocates. We're going to have to sit down and actually talk about for a long period of time. And it's going to be annoying and it's going to be complicated, but we're going to have to talk about what those laws would actually look like because we are going to need them eventually. It's just a matter of what it looks like. I mean, the reality is that a lot of these companies say that they want to participate in that process and they want meaningful privacy rules, but an informed consumer with the tools to understand what's happening is more often not going to opt out of having their data collected. That's just a reality. So they will lose money if they support rules that, you know, provide consumers with more tools and more transparency. So it's a very complicated situation, and I think we're going to have to get to a point where lawmakers take consumer rights a little more seriously before we actually see any traction.
Yeah, in regards to public outcry on things like this and compared to things like Cambridge Analytica, how much of a role do you think the press plays in kind of heightening that? Well, awareness, obviously, they hold a big role, but getting people fired up about this sort of stuff, do you think the press is kind of complicit in the sense that they're kind of letting these things pass and that's why it's not bubbling up more?
Well, you have there's a countless number of really excellent security reporters out there that do great work every single day and are really digging into it. But I think the problem, as you guys hinted at earlier, is a lot of this is pretty murky in terms of techno jargon. You know, what are my packets? What does that mean? How much is collected? What does that mean that they know about me? So I don't know what the answer is to that. I honestly don't know. I think the press will ultimately grab hold of that once it becomes more scandalous because that, you know, that sells. So once you have a few more of these major hacks or a few more major security vulnerabilities exposed, I think you'll start to see traction. But it's going to require something pretty major, unfortunately, for I think the press to really find this interesting enough. Perhaps Russians could get involved and that would make it more interesting for everybody to pay attention to. I don't know.
Or more likely than that, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai suddenly having a change of heart and deciding... Mm.
I
want to support the consumers on this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that'll be happening anytime soon. He actually represented Securus in 2012 for legal matters, and Wyden had suggested that he recuse himself, but I'm highly doubting that happened. And Pai also played a big role. As you know, the net neutrality was repealed, but a big part of that wasn't just killing net neutrality. It was killing the FCC's authority to police broadband providers and wireless providers. So he's basically just gutted the FCC's ability to do much of anything about this. And said, okay, the FTC can come in and do this. But the FTC traditionally is pretty inconsistent in terms of enforcement of this kind of stuff. They're also pretty overwhelmed with dealing with everything from bleach labels to a million other products on the shelves. So they're not particularly well suited to handle this. That's been the ISP's goal this whole time, is why they push for net neutrality repeal, is to gut the FCC authority, try to gut state authority over broadband providers, throw everything else at the FTC, and then watch as a lot of the enforcement stuff falls to the cracks. So that puts us in a pretty tricky predicament in terms of holding their feet to the fire on this stuff. And the FTC could act against them declaring that the way that they misled data collection was unfair and misleading in terms of the FCC's authority. But that's going to require a lot more political willpower. And that political willpower is not going to manifest until we see bigger scandals that gets the public a little bit more invested in what's going on.
Well, you've written some awesome work on Tech Dirt, and we really appreciate you taking time to join us today, Carl. Where do you want people to follow you, the work that you're doing online?
I'm a freelancer whose work appears at Motherboard and Tech Dirt, so you can see me at both of those websites.
Awesome.
And I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you both.
Yeah, we'll definitely be in touch because it was great having you on, and I'm a big fan of your work. So,
great. Thank you so much, Carl. All right.
Thanks, Carl.
Right, have a good day.
And his connection was amazing. You're watching it. Like, look at that. His really.
It's like he's sitting right there.
Yeah,
really.
So you haven't made your ISP mad yet.
Right.
This week, Apple officially announced that the next operating system for iPhone will be able to send your exact GPS information to 911, a feature that might save tens of thousands of lives every year. But the Apple Watch and other smartwatches are already saving lives right now. Caitlin McGarry from Tom's Guide explains. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us some of the people that you talk to for this story about smartwatches saving lives.
So I talk to smartwatch owners, first of all, who have experienced seeing a high heart rate on their watches and we're wondering what that meant. They go seek treatment and they find out they have something seriously wrong with them. So in addition to those people, I also talked with cardiologists, researchers who are studying the heart rate data from wearable devices to figure out what it could mean or what that data could be used to diagnose. And I talked to the companies who are making smartwatches and smartwatch accessories.
So the newest version of watchOS for the Apple Watch will tell you if your heart rate is elevated, if it senses that you're not moving around. What is this signal? What could this signal?
So it could really be a whole range of issues. It could be you're having a panic attack. It could be you get an unexpected text message that, you know, shocks you. But it could be something more serious. In some cases, it's someone found out they had a kidney infection and that was their body's response to, you know, trying to fight the infection. I spoke with someone who went to the hospital after seeing his heart rate on his Apple Watch and he found out he was having a pulmonary embolism, which is blood clots in the lung. So it can be a whole range of things and it doesn't necessarily mean anything serious, but it could. So that's what's sending people to find out.
I guess the challenge is when you're looking at your watch and it's telling you something that there might be a problem is getting that person to actually know this is the time to listen or to, you know, pay more attention to that. Obviously, deeper analysis on a deeper level would require the involvement of the FDA, which seems to be happening behind the scenes. Is that kind of where these wearables are headed right now? I feel like 2, 3, 4 years ago, wearables were all about smartwatch and you know, fitness, pedometer, that sort of stuff. But it's kind of evolved over the years, and it seems to get more specific to kind of calling out, you know, possible health issues, health risks. But that involves the FDA, right? Is that the direction?
Yeah, exactly. So these companies can't make any health claims about their devices without the FDA's approval. So there's an FDA pilot program right now with a few companies involved, including Apple and Fitbit, to see if maybe they can fast track the approval of software features in these devices that could potentially diagnose something based on the heart rate data. But I think that these companies have just paid attention to how people have actually used these devices. They realize no one wants a little phone on their wrist. They want to be able to see something actionable, you know, and you can put the sensor so close to the body. It makes perfect sense to take that to the next level and see if we can find out something more actionable from a smartwatch.
You also wrote about glucose testing for smartwatches. Now, this feels like it's been a really elusive target for a long time. I mean, even Theranos started as like a patch or like a wrist watch that could, instead of using needles, could, you know, diagnose all sorts of things. And that did not end so well. So is some of this really like a long way from being a real health device?
The glucose tracking, I think we're still a long way off from that. I spoke to a lot of folks about this, some who are in the glucose tracking and diabetes management industry. And yeah, this has been tried before. There was actually, you know, a watch that tried to non-invasively measure glucose, but it was actually, they used electrical currents through the skin, and it was a really uncomfortable experience for people. So until they figure that part out, I don't think we're going to see glucose tracking in the watch. But we might see more accessories with sensors in them, like smartwatch bands, with, you know, blood pressure monitors, or things that can be sort of swapped in and out depending on, you know, what a person needs. Not everybody needs a smartwatch that can do all of these different things. So I think having that that interoperability, I think that's going to be really key here.
You won't need a glucose monitor in your watch. You'll have Google's contact lens from 2014.
Exactly.
That monitors your glucose level. Free up your watch for other things like telling time. Are there wearables right now that really stand out as far as it's concerned? I mean, obviously the Apple Watch is probably near the top, but there are wearables that aren't necessarily watch first, that are more fitness first, let's say. Is Apple Watch really the only contender here, or did you kind of, have you heard about others that kind of also are on the same level?
No, Apple's definitely not the only contender here. A lot of other companies are working on this. So basically any device with a heart rate sensor in it, that device can be used to potentially down the line diagnose something related to the heart. So Fitbit is in this game. They put a sensor in the Fitbit Ionic and then later in the Fitbit Versa that could potentially diagnose sleep apnea. They're still researching that, so that feature is not yet live. But they are definitely looking at this space very closely and doing a ton of research. Yeah, basically any other device with a heart rate sensor, that's where it's heading.
And would you say that the ones that are finding the most success in being able to do this, it hinges on the software that's built to support that, or is it anything special about the hardware itself? I know I've tried smartwatches on the Android side, and some of the heart rate monitors that are on those were great, and some of them were not so great, and it was pretty obvious. So it seems like there's varying levels of quality when it comes to this kind of stuff. How does that affect what they're able to determine?
So, right, it's not just the quality or accuracy of the heart rate sensor itself, it's also the algorithm, the software that's built on top of that. So you can look at your heart rate on your wrist, and that's fine, but you need an algorithm to be able to basically compare your data to what's normal and what's abnormal and tell you if something is wrong. So that's why Apple and Fitbit are sort of at the top of the pack here, because they've been working on software like this for years. But yeah, it's not just about the sensor. It's about the algorithms and the software.
So anyone who regularly wears an Apple Watch and also has for a long time worn a heart rate sensor, maybe like around their chest, they'll say, you know, it's much more accurate to have it nearer your heart. So are you saying that, you know, Apple also has the heart rate sensor, but then they also use that for the heart study? So if you sign up, then you can be part of the heart study and it's recording something. So you're saying that because it might not be as accurate when I'm exercising, the algorithm makes it accurate enough to do this long-term heart disease study that they're doing?
Yeah, exactly. It's more about trends. So you compare it to your baseline, you compare it to the general population, and the Apple Heart Study, which Apple just launched, and they haven't released any numbers or any sort of preliminary findings from that, but they basically want to determine if the heart rate sensor is accurate enough compared to an electrocardiogram for diagnosing atrial fibrillation. And the way they're doing that is if the watch senses that you could potentially have atrial fibrillation, they will actually send you an electrocardiogram patch to wear on your body, and then you send that back in, and they can then compare the results of your watch and the electrocardiogram to figure out, okay, are these two results the same? Is this wildly off? Why would that be? And then they can develop the software that could be built into the watch.
So anyone who has an Apple Watch, I definitely recommend volunteering for the study. It's super easy. You answer like a couple questions, and then, I mean, I've been in the study for 114 days. I've looked at it. It makes no sense to me, but it doesn't have to, because you're just participating in research, and there's nothing, you know, for no cost to you.
Right. It's really important that it's not just sick people or people who are worried about these conditions to participate in medical research. It's important that healthy people participate in this, because then they have a huge demographic, huge population to compare, and that will make everything much more accurate. So the best thing for people to do at this point, if they're interested in seeing where this goes in the future, is to sign up for research studies like this one.
I know I've heard in the past about doctors not feeling very optimistic about their patients or potential patients going online to like self-diagnose for things before coming in. It's like, leave it up to the professionals. We got you covered. Don't take too much of this on your own, because you might miss something very major, whatever. How does that translate into something like this? Are doctors generally optimistic about this kind of technology? I imagine they would be if it means that somebody comes in and they catch something, but you know, there might be false positives and it might actually make more work, let's say, for the doctor. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think there's some concern about false positives. I'm not seeing any doctors or cardiologists recommending that people wear one of these devices as a way to diagnose themselves. You know, it can't hurt to have this data, because then if something does go wrong, you can, you know, show your doctor in the app, like, this is where my heart is, and they'll have that record to look back on. Yeah, I think that right now it's mostly health insurance companies who are really interested in this, because it encourages people to be more active and it brings costs down across the board. But I think doctors are sort of taking a wait and see approach. Like, they're interested in the research that's being done, and they're open to what could come down the line. But I don't think the false positives are the big concern, but that a smartwatch would tell you that there's nothing wrong with you when there actually is. So that's why, you know, these studies are extremely important for validating the data that comes from the devices.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us. Caitlin McGarry is a senior writer for Tom's Guide, has written for Macworld, PC Worlds, and others. She is at Caitlin_McGarry on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Caitlin. YouTube reigns supreme when it comes to online video. You can basically do a search for pretty much anything, and you're going to find a video about it. You also might waste a bunch of time watching cats do the darndest things. Now Instagram wants a piece of that long-form video pie. Luis Metzakis covers security and social platforms for Wired, and joins us now to talk about the article that you wrote with Lauren Good that dives into IGTV. We should get used to IGTV, apparently. Welcome, Luis.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. It's great to have you back. So first of all, is it even fair to compare this to YouTube in any way, shape, or form? Or is this very different from what we're used to?
I think you definitely can compare it to YouTube, because they're definitely, you know, after it being entertainment, it's not supposed to be a place to share content with your friends. You know, they're launching it with National Geographic, with a couple of brands. They're launching it with a number of creators. They're really, you know, marketing this as a place for you to get entertainment, not as a place to share stuff with your family and friends, which I think is exactly what YouTube is. You know, most people are not broadcasting, you know, their family album on YouTube. I'm sure some people are. It's people who really want to entertain a large audience, and that's exactly what IGTV is supposed to be.
So what are some of the unique attributes here? I know that there's a focus or rather a requirement of vertical video. Is that the only strange thing that's going on here, or what have they done to kind of differentiate it?
So it kind of has that Instagram feel, like the hearts, a lot of the same kind of, you know, Instagram vibe. The videos are also shorter. So YouTube, you can upload hours of footage if you want to, but Instagram is going to be 10 minutes and an hour if you're kind of an approved creator who gets, you know, these special privileges. But for most people, it's going to be shorter clips, but, you know, much longer than a traditional Instagram video, which is only up to a minute. So it's going to be kind of longer vlogs. And like you said, it's going to be vertical, which is not super unique. We've seen that on Instagram for years, but it is kind of unique in this long form setting. You know, it's going to be kind of interesting to see people potentially sitting on their phones and really looking at a vertical video for a long period of time.
So this is for professional creators, not necessarily for consuming or for you know, the average person. So how does Instagram expect to treat, to organize or manage their creators in a better way than YouTube has? Because we've just heard time and again all the problems they have with content and advertising and moderation. How do they think they're going to do this better?
So I think one of the things is that 10-minute limit, because I think what really gets hard with YouTube is that, you know, everything looks fine for the first 10 minutes, and then, you know, minute 15, you know, all of a sudden someone turns into a Nazi, or, you know, minute 20 and they're really just kind of saying something horrible. That's a lot of video to handle, and that's a lot of video to moderate. It's a lot of hours, whereas Instagram is going to be a little bit shorter, which I feel like is going to help them. They've also been fairly good, you know, relatively at moderating, you know, the 1 billion people who use their platform already. So they have a lot of these mechanisms in place. They're not starting from scratch. You know, with that said, I'm definitely going to be looking for how they kind of handle what kind of content is put on here.
And it's not just 10 minutes for everybody, right? There's kind of tiers depending on how popular you are on Instagram. Some people have 10 minutes, but others with an insane amount of followers have more than that. Is that right?
Yeah, they can post up to an hour. And I think the people who are posting those longer videos are going to be, you know, approved, very brand safe. You know, it's going to be the cute dogs, the makeup influencers. It's not going to be people posting political rants. It's not going to be kind of fringe creators. I think it's going to be very commercial. The people who get those privileges are going to be very safe.
So when you say professional creators, you're not just talking about like ABC or CBS or Disney. You're talking about like the people that are the makeup videos. And so I mean, professional, but not highly, you know, mediated like, you know, regular network TV or something.
Yeah, but I think people who are familiar with doing brand partnerships, I think you can call them professional and that this is their day-to-day job. They've, you know, had a lot of sponsored deals in the past. They know how to make brand safe content already. And I think this is fair to say that it's really their job, even if they, you know, started in their basement or whatever. But I still think that they're much more brand safe than someone who's just kind of like, I want to do this to share my political opinion or whatever.
So a lot of the Instagram people who have like brand partnerships or who aspire to have brand partnerships, they're often just taking a picture of themselves with the brand or telling a little, you know, story or a short video. But creating an entire, you know, 10-minute or if these are professionals, like an hour video, that's a lot more complicated. Like, how do you think that's gonna catch on or be easy for them to do?
I think it'll be more expensive for the brands, and I think that it's possible that creators will want to be paid directly by Instagram or paid in a way where they don't just have to broker the deal themselves, you know, some sort of like automated advertising or, you know, automated brand partnerships where maybe like an ad for the product they're talking about comes up or something. I'm sure that Instagram is looking into this because I think that creators are not going to be excited, or they're going to be reluctant, like you said, to create these longer videos, especially because Instagram is so polished. Like, you know, one thing about YouTube is that it's not that polished. You know, there are people kind of doing bloopers or funnier stuff, whereas Instagram is like, you don't even know what these people sound like. They just look beautiful.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a switch. Is like, can you even transition to video? Are you funny? Or are you just pretty?
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, this is all about making money. Obviously, everything is when you're a company like Instagram or Facebook. Talk about ads. We know that they're going to be coming somewhere down the line. There's going to be some monetization around this, but that's not happening initially. Is there any indication as far as how that's going to go?
Well, I think you can pretty safely say that some sort of advertising is coming. Like you said, that's always how these platforms work. I think that you might see like the, you know, very hated but much beloved by advertisers. You might see a mid-roll ad where it's kind of coming in the middle of the video or something. I think you also are going to see a lot of sponsored content. That's kind of the bread and butter of Instagram. And I'm sure that Instagram is going to look for ways to more quickly and effectively connect these people to advertisers. I don't know if it's going to be traditional kind of like the pre-roll ads that you see on YouTube, But you best believe that this is not going to be just a free for all of free content. There's definitely going to be some sort of monetization coming.
Yeah.
So this is aimed at kids, younger kids. I mean, I have a 15-year-old and two 13-year-olds, and already there's a division between the media. My daughter, it's, you know, lots of Netflix, lots of Snapchat. My boys who are 13, it's lots of YouTube, lots of Instagram. And so is the idea that, I mean, and the YouTube, like YouTube has highly developed their algorithm so that, you know, basically it's like a shot in the arm and a steady stream of all the content that they want. And it's like, I don't even complain about the content itself is good. It's just the fact that it never stops and it's exactly what they want. Like, do you think that, I mean, Instagram, obviously owned by Facebook, has a lot of data that could do the same thing. Do you think that's what they're aiming for? Just people to sit in front of their, you know, getting exactly what they want to see for, you know, 12 hours a day?
Yeah, so there is going to be this For You tab, which is going to be, you know, algorithmically generated. That will be the same kind of recommendations that you see on YouTube. I think one interesting aspect of this is I'm curious if your son does all that watching alone or if he uses a laptop or if it's all on his phone, because the vertical video is really awkward to transfer to a laptop or to transfer to a television or a computer. It just doesn't transfer. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, you know, do kids really want to just be on their phones? You know, they want to use their parents' TV. They want to do the kind of look at the stuff with their friends. I think that IGTV is going to be a very solidary experience. And I wonder if that's really what people want. But, you know, Instagram seems to be convinced that the younger generation really likes that vertical video. You don't have to turn your phone to the side. You know, that's kind of a benefit in their mind.
Yeah, I think they like it. I don't think parents do. And I don't necessarily think it's great for society to have more solitary video consuming, but, you know.
Well, they could have a TV in their room that only they watch, right?
You know, yeah.
It's kind of the same thing, I suppose. It's just not in their pocket all the time. I mean, yeah, and that is the big difference, right? YouTube works on all sorts of platforms. It's also kind of designed, because of that, it's designed for the horizontal video thing. So it really translates to all of the other platforms. This is very different. Like, I can't imagine in the future there being an IGTV app for your PlayStation and everything is, you know, with black bars on both sides on your TV in your living room if you want like a lean back experience. It just kind of doesn't seem like it lends itself for that. So it'll be interesting to see what their ambition is long term.
I mean, maybe we'll have a vertical television. I have no idea. Like, maybe, you know, like,
yeah, it's possible, I suppose.
Yeah. Or, you know, a TV that you can flip to the side, you know, maybe that's like what it will be like. But, you know, I really can't predict that. But it is kind of funny to see this development. And I think it is kind of natural. It's a natural move for Instagram. And I'm not surprised by it. But I'm kind of unconvinced whether it will really rise to the same level as, you know, YouTube has. I don't know if it's the right time for that, you know, but maybe they really want to capitalize on the phone. And I think that's going to be, it is going to be a big space. So we'll see. And they already have 1 billion people. So it's not like they're off to a bad start.
Totally. They've got a good foundation. So if anyone can do it, Instagram. Good. Thank you so much for joining us, Luis Matsakis. Where do you want people to find you online?
At El Matsakis is my Twitter, is the best place if you are mad at my article or if you want to talk.
Right on. We appreciate all your work and we appreciate you taking time to join us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys. Have a good rest of your day.
All right, Take care. Too.
And finally,
yes,
this week we are one step closer to Smell-O-Vision.
Oh, goody.
Mm-hmm. VentureBeat reports that the Chinese VR headset developer PMax today will work with Japanese company called Vaxo to bring smells into the VR experience. The PMax 8X or 810, I don't know, will include a fan and a plastic odor cartridge.
Odor cartridges.
Under your eyes and just above your nose, and the fan will waft scented oils at you according to the virtual objects that you encounter in the game. So what they would smell like, then you could smell them. And we should note that Voxo is not the only scent emitter available for VR experiences. It does claim to be the smallest.
Okay.
And VentureBeat did not say how much they cost, each cartridge, but the current range of scents includes fish, ramen, burnt, lady, not burnt lady,
what?
But burnt, and lady. and grassland. Lady looks like it's purple and flowery. I'm hoping it's like perfume.
Yeah, I'm guessing. Like, if it's anything other than that, that's really weird.
That's what's weird about it.
That's one of the many things.
That is maybe the weirdest thing. Lady. Grassland.
That's so strange. Well, they're interchangeable, so you could almost, I suppose, envision like you get a game and you have to buy the scent pack, but it has all the scents that you plug into your VR thing. And what happens when they run out? Do you buy refills?
Yeah.
Could
they possibly burn the skin off your face by accident? Like I'm also interested in that.
Yeah, are these chemicals any good for you to be like spread onto your face while you're playing a game?
And what if you put like the ramen smell in grassland? So whenever you like experienced a big field of grass, it smelled like ramen. Like,
yeah, you're outside eating ramen. That's not weird.
Yeah.
People do that all the time.
I love this idea. I want it.
This is the future that we're talking about here. We thought a long time ago that someday this would happen, and PMax was the one to do it, or whoever this is, the PMax.
No, PMax is the headset. Apparently, it's been on Vaxo is the company, and they've
Vaxo,
worked with others too.
PMax.
I don't know.
Whatever. The name's weird.
Lady smell.
Oh boy. And ultimately at the end of the day, how critical is the smell to what you happen to be doing? Like, is it at all convincing? I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
We will review it on this network if we can.
Smell is important.
I suppose so. Mm-hmm. That's what we've been telling ourselves for years. Mm-hmm. We'll put it to the test and we'll let you know once we get our hands on this, once we get our nostrils on this. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can always be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show. Because you can't get content like this anywhere.
No.
Not everybody talks about lady smells, I'll tell you that. Go to twit.tv/TNW so you can subscribe. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone here who helps us do this show each and every week and laughs at our jokes. Burke, Jammer B, Josh, Colleen, although she's not here today, but she's usually helping out as well. And thanks to you for laughing at our jokes sometimes. We'll see y'all next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.